Welcome to the College Commons Podcast, passionate perspectives from Judaism's leading thinkers, brought to you by HUC Connect, the Hebrew Union College's online platform for continuing education. I'm Joshua Holo, your host.
Welcome to this episode of the College Commons Podcast and our special series in honor of David Ellenson at the HUC Conference in memory of Rabbi Ellenson. I'm delighted to welcome our first guest in this series, Rabbi Dalia Marks. Rabbi Professor Dalia Marks is the Rabbi Aaron D. Pankin Professor of Liturgy and Midrash at the Hebrew Union College and the author of numerous books, including most recently, From Time to Time, Journeys in the Jewish Calendar. She is also the co-editor of the new Israeli Reform Sidur called Tfilat HaAdam, together with Alona Lisitsa. She's a public intellectual in Israel, appearing regularly on Israeli media, and she co-hosts with Rabbi Dan Prat a sister podcast of this one in Hebrew, also on HUC Connect, titled Kanfei Ruach. Rabbi Dalia Marks, thank you for joining us on the College Commons Podcast.
Thank you for having me. Shalom, Josh.
I'd like to speak a little bit about Tfilat HaAdam, the topic of your discussion here at the conference. In your presentation of the Sidur, you point out how a prayer book reflects not merely the interior life of a person who's praying, but also the life of a community. How so?
We have to remember that Sidurim, prayer books, are probably the most common books in the Jewish culture, in the Jewish tradition. If you were Jew living in Hamburg or in Tzana or in the Middle East, in the 16th century or before that or a little bit after that, and you owned just one volume, remember, books were so scarce, it would probably not be Maimonides or the Talmud or the Mishnah, not even the Bible or the Torah. It would be a Siddur. It would be a prayer book. It would be a precious volume that is transmitted from generation to generation. This is a Siddur. It's not just a book. It's a book that is enacted. Don't just read it, we perform it. It comes to life through our words, through our physical gestures, through our reciting it in the family setting, in the community. So yes, it reflects a community, but it also creates a community. The way that Sidur editors create the Sidur shows you how they understand the community that the Sidur is intended to. In terms of not just the text, of course, we in the Reform movement are very sensitive to the theology and the ideology and literary sensitivities that we have in the liturgical text, but also the layout, the font, the priorities that are given in graphic settings. So this is something that is very interesting for me, theoretically, but also very practically. When we came to create the Sidur, we wanted the person who holds it to know who is the community that he wants to serve.
It's a fine line between a communal shaper and a political one. And we think of the Sidur as something that is very, very ancient. And it's relatively ancient, but it's not truly ancient insofar as it was really formed by some of the great Geonim, great rabbi leaders in the Middle East in the 9th, 10th centuries, that Rav Amram's Sidur, Saatya Gaon also standardized. And in standardizing these Sidurim, they also established power structures and communal boundaries.
That's right. However, you know, the whole liturgical process, you talk about the moment of formation of what we call Sidur, prayer book today, but Jews prayed much before that. The main building block of the tefillah, of the prayer, existed already at the end of the second or third century. Right? And it continued to be shaped and reshaped until the invention of the printing press. Yeah, even in the 14th century, the greatest scholar, Rabbi David Abu Dirham, the most famous commentary on the Sidur, he said, "I never saw two identical prayer books." That's a big thing, because you create your own Sidur, and you remember that your grandfather used to say this here, so you add a little supplication or a prayer or a hymn or a psalm. Every Sidur was, in a way, very personalized. The printing press made the Sidurim very well spread and not so expensive anymore from an economic point of view. It was much more accessible for everyone. But it also standardized. I mean, in a way, it kind of killed a little bit the creativity of the Siddur. Until a certain moment, things could enter the prayer book. It was a one-door room. You know, you can check out anytime you want and you can never leave. At a certain moment with the printing press and on the verge of modernity, that door was closed. So if you're in, you're in. And if you're not in, you cannot go in. And that's the great achievement of the reform movement, right? We said, you know, we're going to open that door, but we're going to open another door. So new things can come in, but things that are not working for us anymore can leave. You know, why do we need to pray for the heads of the yeshivas in Babylon that ceased to exist 1,000 years ago, right? Why do we need to say a prayer for them? Or we may want to say something else for our teachers, for our scholars. So that's the great invention of the reform movement. And that's a great debate between denomination within Judaism. But I think even those who oppose to us, who don't agree with our path, also create new liturgy. Yeah. In the most inner circles of Hasidism, they create piyutim, liturgical hymns for remembering the Holocaust. They wanted to, again, to create their own identity by changing a few things from the traditional Ashkenazic version. And thus they call it Sfarado.
Right, right. So let's talk about that particular reform movement capacity to put their ideology into print in the Siddur. And in that process, which has been ongoing and iterative for generations now, you paraphrased our colleague, Rabbi Peter Noble, who said that a reform prayer book should be both more traditional and more radical.
Right.
What's the creative tension in the pull in these two opposite directions that Rabbi Noble of Blessed Memory is asking us to do?
Right. So the way I understand what he says is that we are Reformed Jews, but first and foremost, we are Jewish people. We're Jews when we have to connect not only with the previous Reform Siddur or prayer book, but with the liturgical wisdom of our people in whole. And there were quite a few passages that were omitted from classical Reform Siddurim. I can understand why, but I think some of the reasons for these omissions or editing out major building block of the Siddur don't apply anymore. So we wanted to include them. We want every Jew to feel at home in our synagogues. We reintroduced the Musaf service, the additional service for Shabbat, which was a big no-no for the Reform movement because it stands as a reminder of the additional offering at the temple.
The reluctance of Reform Jews being that A, we didn't want to reconsecrate sacrificial way of connecting with God, and we were reluctant to welcome the rebuilding of the third temple.
And the two goes together.
Right, they're related.
But it is a prayer that is in our tradition, and we brought it in. This is, by the way, something that I learned from our teacher, David Ellenson. We brought it in, but we made some changes. And instead of asking for the rebuild of the temple and the reinstitution of the sacrifices, we remember that that's how it was. And we ask to worship God in a new way. In other words, I think that keeping dirty little secrets in the family, not talking about them, is not a good thing. We don't talk about the sacrifice. We completely cleanse the Siddur out of it. And I don't think that that's good. I think we have to talk about it. We have to acknowledge it. And we have to say that we're in a different place right now. And there are other things that we're taking out of the Siddur. For example, the daily psalm. Every day, the Levites in the temple used to sing a song, a special psalm. And we took it out. And why? I think it's beautiful because it really adds. That's part of the creative nature of our liturgy.
Do you have an inkling as to why we took it out in the first place?
First of all, we tried to shorten the tefillah. That's one thing. And second, because it was performed in the temple.
I see.
And the Mishnah says, this is how the Levites used to say in the temple. On Sunday, they used to say that they recite Psalm 24. On Monday, etc. And we said, you know, actually, if there was something in the temple that we can relate to, is the prayers and the psalms. Why would we take it out? And it really gives a special flavor to each day. Yeah, and if we are in the Reform movement, all about feeling the moment and giving each day its own meaning, that can work with that. And also the sanctification of the new moon, It's the big no-no for a lot of people. And in my movement, we had so many debates. A lot of people really blame me for bringing paganism into this.
Some back, right.
Right? Because what you do in that Kiddush Levanai, the sanctification of the moon, you basically dance toward the moon and you say, you talk to the moon and you try to touch the moon. And you see, you sometimes see it in Jerusalem. People dance in the middle of the night trying to reach the moon. But we thought it's a beautiful text. It's about nature. It's about the creation. It's about community, because part of this prayer is that you approach people and you say Shalom Aleichem, and they respond Aleichem Shalom. And it's all about being preserved in God's womb, if you want, right? It's also not a very common image of God as a mother, in a way. So why not include that? So that's the part of going back to a more traditional form of liturgy. On the other hand, we stretched the liturgy more to the other side, making it more radical in the sense that we added prayers that you may not call prayers. Modern poetry, not all of it addresses God in a way that is very direct. You can infer from it a prayer to God, but you can also understand it otherwise. In terms of gender, of course, we added the names of the mothers, and we added whenever you have a male form, speaking first person, Modani, you have Modani. We included a lot of female creativity, poets, like the name of the Sidur is called Tfilat Adam, that's based on a poem by Hannah Senesh. And also we experimented, that was one of the more controversial parts of our work, with what we sometimes refer to as God language. If we say that God does not have a body or image of a body, fine, but if we call God a king, a father, a judge, a shepherd, and all these forms in Hebrew are in male form, what are we actually saying? So we experimented a little bit about it. Sometimes we refer to God as Ruach HaOlam, the spirit of the world, or Nefesh Kol Chai, the spirit of all living, or Shechina Mekol Chayenu, the presence of God who is the source of our lives. But most of these experiments are on the creative part of the Siddur. The Siddur has two colors. It has a very clear color code. The black font has a more traditional look to it. And that's the traditional prayer as we understand it in the Reform movement. And then we have texts in blue on the side that are more creative and more contemplative and modern. And some of them are more ancient in a way that's basically not so different from what Mishkan Tfilah did.
Yes.
Although we have it on the same page. It's a fully Hebrew text. Although a year after the Siddur came out, we created a translation of the Siddur, not the entire Siddur, just the Shabbat part. This is a bilingual text created by Rabbi Levi Wyman Kelman and Rabbi Efrat Odem.
Peter Noble's position reminds me of something that another prominent rabbi in the late 20th century, Arnold Jacob Wolf, he used to say that we Jews need to get ritually more traditional and politically more radical.
Wow.
So yeah. There's an echo of each other in that.
Yeah, I think prayer has to move you.
No.
Prayer has to call you for action. Prayer can also be very soothing and pleasant, but prayer can also be, you know, a little bit edgy, a little bit, you know, push you to do stuff.
The College Commons podcast belongs to HUC Connect, the online platform for continuing education from the Hebrew Union College. HUC Connect includes webinars, syllabi for community learning, and masterclasses for HUC alumni, with interviews, expert panels, and classroom materials on topics ranging from the arts to civil society, Israel, and much more. Check us out at huc.edu/HUC Connect. Now, back to our interview.
Did you struggle with the idea of redemption and its associated idea of messianism?
Yes, of course. I think one of the things that kept Judaism so much alive and made Jews strive for better life at the front row of so many social action movements, feminism, race justice, gender justice, all these things, we strive for a messianic age. We're really in the process of getting there. As you and I and everybody who listens to us now knows, we are not there. And if we had any thought that we are, we know now that we're not there. We have a lot of work to do and to strive and to fight and to struggle until Israel can be reshit tzmichat v'geulatenu, the beginning of the
sprouting,
beginning
of the beginning of the beginning of the...
Exactly. But this is what I understand prayer calls us to do. It's not about being satisfied and happy with the situation. It's about the movement.
But what about the risk of the messianic zeal? I think the reform movement in the first half of the 20th century was most worried about the embodiment of the messianic hope in the person of an individual, which is redolent of Christianity and was off-putting to them. But I think today our fear is the certainties of messianic zeal that can pose real dangers of uncritical self-justification.
Absolutely. You just need to open the newspaper in Israel and see all the things you warn against right in front of you. I think we talk about a messianic age for, you know, future redemption as something that is very intrinsically tied to social justice and to gender justice and to national justice. You cannot achieve it by discrimination against other, by being careless about human life. We see what happens in Israel now. You know, you see careless toward the life of Palestinians, and then it filters in Israel, and you have careless of people's life altogether, regardless of race and nationality and religion.
Since our previous conversation about this and other work of yours, October 7th has taken place, and I want to ask you if you have received feedback or responses to Tfilat HaAdam in particular, either in relation to October 7th or as an outgrowth of October 7th. And if so, I'm really curious to hear what the most meaningful and profound responses you've had in relation or as an outgrowth of October 7th. And also perhaps, what are the most troubling and disquieting responses you may have had?
Wow. First, I would call this time since the massacre and the terrible war we're in, that's the most liturgical war we ever experienced. I don't remember anything like it. Hundreds and hundreds of prayers were written from day one. And now not anymore. Now people are so sad and distraught. But from day one, many prayers and supplications and trinot and eulogies and lamentations. Many, many prayers were written. As for Tfilat HaAdam, I was actually in New York when it happened, and I started getting calls from people. Can it be that we did not include in the Siddur the prayer Achenu, our brothers and sisters, the entire house of Israel? We did not include it. And I was so embarrassed about it. The first thing I did when I came back to Israel, I printed stickers and we put on all the Sidurim that we have in our campus in Jerusalem, and we send them to all the rabbis to put them. That's another thing to show you that the traditional liturgy, sometimes you feel that it's outdated and not needed anymore. And all of a sudden, actually it's needed. It's something that has its own gravitas. So we did not include it. That's on the list of what to add on the third edition of Tfilat HaAdam, yes.
Any startling or concerning responses you've had? Has anybody troubled you in their response?
So first of all, you have all these theological questions. It's not related specifically to the Siddur. You know, how could it happen? And how could it happen, especially to those people who dance in a peace party or in these kibbutzim who strived so hard to be in just and peaceful relationship with their neighbors? These are enduring questions. I don't think I have good answers to this. However, in the new Machzor, maybe we'll say a word about it that we're working on. As we speak, it's in the printing house and it's almost the full version, but we did not include the Yizkor service. We felt that we cannot have the Yizkor service. I mean, we have a draft, but we didn't print it because it's too fresh. You know, the war still goes on. So we felt like we can't really talk about it as something that is part of the past. It's too fresh. So we did not include the Yizkor service in that machzor yet.
I have to say that is so counterintuitive. What is it about the Yizkor service that makes you feel that it's retrojecting loss and memory to a far distant past. Isn't the whole point of the Yizkor service that that experience is part of the cyclical, annual cyclical, but also human cyclical experience of life? Mm-hmm. And it's also the prayerful moment for mourning, for regular mourning as well. Mm-hmm. Not just a martyrology of a distant, distant past. We revivify it mm-hmm. on purpose.
Now, just to be clear, this is going to be Yizkor service in the Keilot. We just didn't feel like we can summarize this chapter in our people. And it's not about the distant past. If you think about the birth of the Yizkor service, which is one of the newcomers to the liturgy, it was edited in Ashkenaz, in the German communities, in the framework of the programs the Crusaders carried out in the Rhineland communities. And the Yizkor came just after that. So it wasn't like a memory of a long past suffering. It was something that was very immediate, but we felt like we're still in the middle of it and we cannot look at it in a clear way. We needed some distance. So Yizkor is going to take place in our communities, but we did not want to sort of dictate a text yet.
Understood. Thanks for talking it out. I can imagine it was very difficult. Among the other perhaps difficult ideas, I want to plumb a little bit of the tension, especially in Reform Judaism, between universalism and particularism. And particularly, I'm thinking about the work of editing, which is about, among other things, choosing. You can't have everything, and one thing comes at the expense of another, and so you have to choose. From the liturgical perspective of editing, does universalism come at the expense of particularism? And what does that mean to you?
So usually we think about it this way, that traditional Jewish liturgy is more toward the particular, looking at ourselves as a people, as a nation, as a religion, and disregarding to some extent, not entirely, but for the most part, the entire world, entire humanity, universe. And then we think about Reform Judaism, reiterating, stressing the universalism and on the expense of particularism. My take on it was, let's have both. Full volume.
Yeah.
Both, right? Let's talk about ourselves as the people, as a nation, looking inwards, but not on the expense of seeing ourselves as citizens of the world. And this is something that we don't necessarily see in American Reform liturgy. All the Kaddishim says, Oseh Shalom Yomran, may God make peace above and for all the people of Israel. And we also have Ve'al Kol Yoshvei Tevel, and for all the inhabitants of the world. It's really part of it. And I think in Israel, we have to be even more careful about some of these things than maybe North American communities, because some of these particular sentences are used as hate language. These are the kind of graffiti that is smeared on monasteries and mosques, words from Aleinu L'Shabeach, for example. And here we took them out. All the who did not make us like,
who did not make us like the other families of peoples in the world.
Yes, you know, the us and them in a way that says that we are better than others. We just took them out. We felt that in the Israeli context, these are dangerous words. I'm not criticizing Americans for not taking it out, but I'm saying in Israel, these are words that are used in a bad way.
We started our conversation talking about how the printing press solidifies and in some cases stultifies the creativity of the Siddur, but it also gives power to the things it chooses. And by solidifying your word choice in print, you may allow fewer things in from year to year, day to day, but you're really pushing those ideas.
Right. It's a lot of responsibility.
It's a lot of responsibility. You can only imagine. And this is an interesting case of that, because it's true that in Reform Siddurim in the English language, at least in North America, we don't generally have printed Ve'al Kol Yoshvei Tevel for Oseh Shalom B'Marav. He who brings peace on high also brings peace on the world and all peoples within it. In many congregations, we do say it or sing it, but we don't print it. And there's a difference, and you're highlighting that difference. It's also true that we have different versions of the Aleinu, and they echo another theme that we talked about before, which is that many of them have pasted in the alternative readings after the printing was done. and some of them don't. And some of us sing one way and another way. For the Aleinu, I'm talking about the ones, right. The phrase that talks about us being different from the other families of peoples on the planet. There's these degrees of permanentizing these ideas in print. It really brings home a lot of the questions you address.
Right. In Mishkan Tefillah, before the Gates of Prayer, in the Union Prayer Books, you have beautiful versions of Aleinu L'Shabeach. We felt like we need to be closer to the origin in terms of the language, but there are some phrases we cannot include. But we also have the Marsha Falk, beautiful rendition of Aleinu L'Shabeach. She wrote beautifully both in Hebrew and in English. Not all poets can do both languages, and she can. And a lot of people like it because it's short and it's very poetic.
Nice. Well, take us out of this interview with an introduction to your next major liturgical venture.
We're working on a high holiday machzor. This time it's Rabbi Eliora, Ezra Chivered, and I. And that's a great joy to be able to create a new liturgy, especially in days like this. It's more difficult to work on a high holiday liturgy because it takes place once a year. There's only one day that's Yom Kippur, so Kol Nidrei happens once a year, and Rosh Hashanah happens 2 days a year. So we cannot really experiment on it the way we did with the Siddur, because the Siddur, we had drafts and we sent them to congregation, and then we received them back with a lot of feedback, and then we sent them again to other congregations. A lot of this kind of process, we're not going to be able to do that. So it's even scarier than the Siddur in that sense. But on the other hand, we feel that we are approaching larger community when we deal with the Siddur. I think a lot of people, when they want to know about the Reform movement in Israel, I think the ultra-Orthodox object us even more than in the past, maybe because they're more threatened. But the larger population is interested. And I'm talking about secular to modern Orthodox. And it's good that you can just give them a book and say, that's part of what we do. That's our liturgy. That's how we pray. That's how we worship. These are our sources. And I think that that's very valuable. And I know that a lot of people from even more traditional settings than us are using parts of the Siddur or are influenced by it or emulating on it. And that's a great privilege to be able to do that. Yeah. And now we're working on the Machzor. And yes, you know, time will tell how it will be received. I hope it will be well received. Yes.
Well, good luck to you, my friend and colleague, Rabbi Dalia Marks. Thank you so much for joining us. And thank you for all the work.
Thank you.
We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the College Commons Podcast, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And check out HUC Connect, compelling conversations at the forefront of Jewish learning. For more information about all that HUC Connect has to offer, visit huc.edu/HUC Connect.